morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, it has been 56 years since Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered in Memphis, Tennessee, by an assassin named James Earl Ray on this date, April 4th, 1968, a day that should live in the minds of Americans as one of infinitely tragic infamy, but is instead one celebrated by the nation's racist core as one of jubilation in the same manner as ancient pagans reveled in the crucifixion of a claimant as son of a heretical god opposed to the imperial pantheon of Roman deities, as well as a convicted usurper of Judean gospel. Both were springtime martyrs, as though virility demanded human sacrifice. Also, on today's date, in 1841, America's ninth president, William Henry Harrison, died after only a single month in the White House. Not only the shortest term president, but also for this exact reason, the nation's best chief executive, because he was not in the White House long enough to make any mistakes, which might endow him with a golden sheen to counter his relative obscurity. I start today's program with a Yahoo News article by Ricky L. Jones, updated from the Courier Journal on April Fool's Day. What would Martin Luther King Jr. think of America 56 years after his assassination? All of the healers have been killed or betrayed. Gil Scott Heron, Winter in America. And that's the bit of his leader into it. By 1968, Martin Luther King was flailing, like W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and others. He had been abandoned by many leaders of the NAACP and other black legacy organizations. He was still hounded by the U.S. government, as J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO continued efforts to destroy black leaders and resistance to racial inequality. He was struggling to hold together his own coalition of lieutenants, like Ralph Abernathy, Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, Hosea Williams, and others, who all quickly went their separate ways after King's death. King had not had a major victory in years, and his popularity had plummeted. As he neared death, almost 75% of Americans disapproved of him, labeling him a race-baiting troublemaker. Painfully for him, even a majority of black people did not support him. Those closest to King wondered how he could go on as he tumbled into depression. The immediate past provided no encouragement in 1968. Medgar Evers had been shot to death in his Jackson, Mississippi driveway in June 1963. King's simultaneous rival and comrade, Malcolm X, was murdered just over a year before. W.E.B. Du Bois, one of Black America's greatest intellectuals, had given up 7 years earlier. He wrote to his friend Grace Gowans in September of 1961, "I just cannot take any more of this country's treatment. Chin up and fight on, but realize that American Negroes can't win." Du Bois left for Ghana that next month and never returned. He died the day before the 1963 March on Washington, a mere 2 months after Evers. K. King's 13 years on the front lines of America's Civil Rights War ended when he was murdered in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968, today's date. He was only 39 years old. King did not live to see racist anti-black politicians and pundits misuse his words, arguing people should, quote, not be judged by the color of their skin, but the content of their character, unquote, to oppose black progress. He did not live to see the Civil Rights Act of 1964, for which he fought for, so fiercely weaponized by the U.S. Supreme Court and attorneys general like Kentucky's Russell Coleman, to justify the legal destruction of affirmative action, diversity initiatives, and set the fight for racial equality back decades. King did not live to see the voting rights of 1965, of which he was so proud, gutted, and rendered little more than a dead letter by the opponents of racial equality. King did not leave to see cowardly black free riders, not freedom riders, who will not open their mouths in defense of their people, benefit from his sacrifice and suffering. He did not live long enough to see the Ward Connollys, Clarence Thomases, Candace Owens, and Daniel Camerons of the world. He didn't live to see Tim Scott skinning, grinning, and genuflecting before Donald Trump as he bastardized the words of Fannie Lou Hamer. He did not live long enough to see a black man running for governor of North Carolina proudly proclaim that black people owe America reparations. Nor did King live long enough to see a black president or the unrelenting white backlash that has followed him. The searing, truth-telling writer James Baldwin did not see most of it either. He outlived King by 21 years, eventually dying in 1987 during the racial onslaught of the Reagan era. He was only 63. For those decades, Baldwin was the one left behind. He lived long enough to bear witness to the grief, pain, and white retribution that followed his friends' murders. What Baldwin saw was neither pretty nor encouraging. He damningly reflects on America in Raoul Peck's Oscar-nominated documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart which is happening in my country. These people have deluded themselves for so long that they really don't think I'm human. I base this on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters. And that was James Baldwin. Current political and social anti-blackness has grown more and more brazen in America, and, unfortunately, there are no Kings or Baldwins left to fight it. What would Baldwin, King, and their fellow warriors think of America today? The Christina Lee Brown Envirom Institute's Baldwin-King Project, which I founded, will wrestle with that question on the 56th anniversary of King's death today at Roots 101 African American Museum in Louisville, Kentucky at 5 p.m. And that was by Dr. Ricky L. Jones, who is the Baldwin King Scholar in Residence at the Christina Lee Brown Envirom Institute and Professor of Pan-African Studies, University of Louisville. His column appears biweekly in the Courier Journal. He is also on Facebook, LinkedIn, Threads, and X. And now, Oregon is recriminalizing drugs. year is what Portland learned by Mike Baker. Oregon's governor has signed a measure to reimpose criminal penalties for hard drugs. Mayor Ted Wheeler of Portland talks about why the experiment failed. When Oregon embarked on a landmark plan 3 years ago to decriminalize hard drugs, it was wagered that a focus on treatment over punishment would create a new model for drug policy around the country. But after a deluge of overdose deaths and frequent chaos in the streets of Portland, Governor Tina Kotek signed into law this past Monday a measure to restore criminal penalties for drug possession. It brought to an end a key portion of one of the nation's most ambitious attempts to find alternatives other than jail for drug users, embodied in a 2020 voter initiative known as Measure 110. The rollback has supporters among a wide range of public officials, including Mayor Ted Wheeler of Portland, who found himself presiding over a series of crises since taking office in 2016. They included surging unsheltered homelessness, turbulent street protests, an exodus of downtown businesses, record numbers of homicides, the rapid spread of fentanyl, and soaring overdose deaths. Over the past year, Mr. Wheeler has set out to restore order. He has battled in court to ban daytime camping and tried to establish mass shelter locations, known in Portland as TASS sites, T-A-S-S, for those without housing. After initially supporting budget cuts to the police department, he has pushed to increase the law enforcement presence in the city and to crack down on crime. And he concluded that it was time to restore criminal penalties for hard drug possession. Under the new law, people caught with small amounts of drugs could face up to 180 days in jail, although lawmakers also built in a series of off-ramps that allow people in many cases to get treatment instead of confinement. Mayor Wheeler sat down with the New York Times recently to discuss the shift on drug policy and his city's future. Following are excerpts from that interview. The question: there's concern that bringing back criminal penalties is going back to the war on drugs. Is that what is happening? Answer: the war on drugs didn't work. And so I hope the answer to that question is no. And I hope this is not an excuse for people to turn their backs on the hard work of building a mental health system. We're doing that, and we're doing it at the very local level. At our TASS sites, we actually went out and we contracted at the municipal level with service providers who can provide basic behavioral health, substance use disorder, domestic violence treatment, job training. We're creating those pathways. So we appreciate that the legislature took the steps to return law enforcement and public safety tools to our first responders. I think that was necessary, but it is also necessary to do the hard work to build the behavioral health infrastructure that was lacking. Question: when you look back to 2020, when Measure 110 was passed, you had pretty wide support in Oregon. In Portland, 3/4 of voters in this area approved it. I'm curious how excited you were at the time about this new path that was emerging. And the response: I was cautiously optimistic. I've been around enough to know that it's always in the implementation. Question: where do you think things most went wrong with the measure? Response: there's no question that the state botched the implementation. And as I say, the timing could not have been worse. In terms of the botched implementation, to decriminalize the use of drugs before you actually had the treatment services in place was obviously a huge mistake. with the benefit of hindsight, the way that should have been structured is that it would create the mechanism for funding. The state would build up its behavioral health service, and when it reached a certain threshold, then they would decriminalize. It should not have gone the other way around. The truth is that addiction rates and overdose rates skyrocketed. I personally do not attribute all of that to the passage of Measure 110. I think you can see national trends that would suggest that it wasn't all ballot Measure 110, but it was very easy for the public to draw a line between the passage of Measure 110, the decriminalization of hard drugs, the increase in addiction, and the increase in overdoses and criminal activity associated with drugs. Question. You have said that you have been concerned about the future viability of this city. What does a worst-case scenario look like to you? Response. A worst-case scenario is a city where you don't have laws that can be enforced. You don't have alternative treatment for those who are ready to be treated, and you lose the public's trust in your local institutions of democracy. That's when things start to unwind. We are not there. And I will tell you, from where I was sitting 4 years ago today, night and day difference. I am very optimistic about the future of this city. I can see it. I mean, the city looks much better. Foot traffic is way up. Criminal activity is way down. With the opening of our task sites, with the expansion of our services at our safe rest villages, we have 1,000 new shelter beds we did not have even a year ago. Things have improved. Question. At the same time, in relatively recent polling, I think 81% said they feel unsafe about going downtown in Portland at night. Are they wrong to feel that way? Response. I would never tell anybody they're wrong to feel unsafe. If you feel unsafe, you feel unsafe. And that is your prerogative. What I would say is, objectively, crime rates are way down. Question. I was looking back when you first ran for office in 2015. One of your big messages was trying to deal with this nexus of homelessness and mental health issues and addiction. You had vowed at the time to eliminate unsheltered homelessness by 2018. What went wrong? Response. Well, first of all, I'm not a great predictor of the future, it turns out. I don't think anybody in 2015 could have possibly imagined where we would be today, as a city, as a state, as a nation. In 2015, P2P meth did not exist. Fentanyl did not exist. We hadn't seen the explosion in the homeless population that we saw, particularly during the pandemic, but also leading up to the pandemic. What happened there, I think, honestly, is the long-term decisions we had made as a state to not invest in behavioral health, to not invest in treatment services, came home to roost as all of these crimes hit simultaneously during COVID. Question, do you look at yourself and say, I have blame in this? Response, I think we all have blame in this. Of course, we have somewhat reaped what we have sown, and I don't just mean here in Portland, Oregon. I mean as a nation. Our nation has been very slow to accept behavioral health as an important issue. It's starting to happen. It's happening with particularly a younger generation being more willing to talk about it openly. Question. Along with this rollback of Measure 110 across the country, there's been a shift toward more conservative policies on policing and crime and drug policy. What do you think is motivating that shift? Response. People are exhausted from feeling like they're under siege. They want order restored to their environment, and that makes perfect sense to me. These are very dislocating times. these are uncertain times for people economically, socially, in terms of the environment. There are so many existential threats. I mean, even despotism is seeming to grow worldwide. These are very uncertain times. And you see it particularly among young people. I feel it. I think other people feel it too. And so they have a minimum expectation that where they live is an orderly, safe, secure, prosperous place to be. And if they don't see it, that is unsettling. They need to have that. Question. For other states or cities that are thinking about drug decriminalization, it might not be this year. Maybe it's down the line. What would be your guidance? Response. The treatment infrastructure has to be in place first. Question. Do you think there is a future where decriminalization could happen again? Or have we learned some other lesson about hard drugs in society? Response. I do believe there is a future where decriminalization in favor of treatment could happen, but it can't happen if you don't have the treatment, and that seems self-evident. There is no question that what Oregon did was a bold experiment, and it failed. Let's just be honest about that. It was botched in terms of the implementation. The timing was wrong, and frankly, the politics were wrong. Going forward, could this experiment happen again? I don't think anybody will completely decriminalize the use of drugs. I wouldn't support it personally, but the piece about providing enough behavioral health services is critically important. And again, in this country, we have not done that. And that was... Oregon is Recriminalizing Drugs by Mike Baker, who is a national reporter for the New York Times based in Seattle. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. I think dear old Mother Nature would have preferred that human development had been chronologically frozen in the early ice ages, perpetually spearing woolly mammoths and saber-toothed tigers. But we must rush ahead or perish. Even though it is significantly evident we are rushing to suicide through ecocide, we seem to understand we have no other choice to escape biocide from decay. Death and despair propel us into the future, where they wait to fatally ambush us. Everyone, as Tiny Tim might say.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.